Today is Wednesday, May the 15th, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, which is www.prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. T-Mobile could be profiling you. And how do you opt out? The newly added profiling option is available on the T-Mobile's privacy dashboard. T-Mobile's history of questionable privacy practices continues with a newly discovered profiling toggle in its privacy center, first discovered by the Mobile Report. This new profiling toggle is set to on by default and enables the carrier to perform automated profiling of user data. The exact time frame remains unclear, but this concerning feature appears to have been active for at least a month, as evident by Reddit discussions. This is T-Mobile's description of the profiling feature in its privacy notice. Profiling is a specific type of activity under certain privacy laws and generally refers to the automated processing of personal data to evaluate, analyze, or predict certain personal aspects about your performance at work, economic situation, health, personal preferences, interest, reliability, behavior, location, or movements. You can opt out of having profiling used for future decisions that produce legal or similarly significant effects about you. This feature is meant to allow T-Mobile to use your data to create a behavioral profile which could be used to anticipate your needs or actions when seeking support. However, the broad definition opens the door for T-Mobile to collect a concerning amount of sensitive data, including location, interest, financial status, and even health information. In the Mobile Report, notably, users were never directly notified about this feature's addition or the policy change. Plus, the fact that the toggle is enabled by default raises serious concerns about breach of trust. As consumers, we should have the power to explicitly consent to this type of data collection rather than being forced to opt out manually. To toggle this feature off, you can access T-Mobile's Privacy Center dashboard and follow these steps. Log into your T-Mobile account with full account permissions. Next, on desktop, click Edit Profile Settings. On your mobile apps, tap More, then Profile Settings. Find Privacy and Notifications and select Privacy Dashboard. Scroll down to find the Profiling and Automated Decisions section and turn it off. Unfortunately, T-Mobile does not allow you to turn off this feature for your entire account at once. You must repeat these for each individual line under your account. This is not the first time T-Mobile has quietly opted users into data collection practices. The rise of AI and data prediction is unavoidable, and companies' use of them is likely to become increasingly common. However, this growth must be accompanied by careful consideration of ethical implications and user privacy. Caveat emptor. Customer says Meta's ad buying user AI is not working. Based on your point of view, the artificial intelligence either doesn't work or it works too well. The idea was to use a Meta-developed AI to automatically set up ads and spend your ad budget, saving you the hassle of making decisions about your ad campaign. Apparently, the AI funnels money to Meta a little too well. Customers say it burns daily ad budgets in a matter of hours, and costs are inflated as much as tenfold. The AI-powered software in question is the Advantage Plus shopping campaign. The system is supposed to automate a lot of ad setup for you, mixing and matching various creative elements and audience targets. The power of artificial intelligence-powered advertising is that the ad platform can get instant feedback on its generated ads via click-through rates. You give it a few guardrails, and it can try hundreds or thousands of combinations to find the most clickable ad at a speed and efficiency no human can match. Well, that's the theory anyway. Similar stories are being hit by an AI-powered spending spree once they let Meta system take over a campaign. AI had blown through roughly 75% of the daily ad budgets for clients in under a couple of hours, and that the ads' costs were roughly 10 times higher than normal. Meanwhile, the revenue earned from those AI-powered ads were nearly zero, the report says. Small businesses have seen their ad dollars get wiped out and wasted as a result, and some have said the bouts of overspending are driving them from Meta's platforms. Meta's Advantage Plus sales pitch promises to use machine learning to identify and aim for your highest value customers across all of Meta's family of apps and services with minimal input. The service can automatically test up to 150 creative combinations and deliver the highest performing ads. Meta promises that on average, companies had seen a 17% reduction in cost per action. An action is typically a purchase, registration, or sign-up, and a 32% increase in return on ad spend. In response to the complaints, a Meta spokesperson said the company had fixed a few technical issues and that our ad system is working as expected for the vast majority of advertisers. We recently fixed a few technical issues and are researching a small amount of additional reports from advertisers to ensure the best possible results from businesses using our apps. It is reported that advertisers are still having issues. The report describes the service as unpredictable and says what other marketers thought was a one-time glitch by Advantage Plus ended up becoming a recurring incident for weeks. To make matters worse, layoffs in Meta's customer service department mean it's been difficult to get someone at Meta to deal with AI spending sprees. Some accounts report receiving refunds after complaining, but it can take several tries to get someone at customer service to deal with you and upward of a month to receive a refund. Some customers quoted in the report have decided to return to pre-AI non-automated ways of setting up a Meta ad campaign, which can take an extra 10 to 20 minutes. Oh, by the way, why didn't Meta apply AI to their customer service department? Understanding artificial intelligence product labeling. When it comes to labeling a product as AI, it is important to understand that simply adding the term AI to a product does not inherently make it an AI product. While the use of AI in product labeling and design is prevalent, it's important to recognize that labeling a product as AI does not automatically make it an AI product. The ethical considerations, transparency in content labeling, and the impact of AI on product design and consumer experience are essential aspects to consider in the context of AI product labeling. Logitech recently announced a new mouse. The most distinct feature of the Logitech Signature AI Edition M750 is a button located south of the scroll wheel. This button is pre-programmed to launch the ChatGPT prompt builder, which Logitech recently added to its peripheral configuration apps option. Beyond that, the M750 looks just like the Logitech Signature M650, which came out in January 2022. According to Logitech, the M750 appearing to be the M650, but with an extra button, a spokesperson responded by saying, M750 is indeed not the same mouse as M650. It has an extra button that can be pre-programmed to trigger the larger AI prompt builder once the user installs larger options plus apps. Without option plus, the button does DPI toggle between 1000 and 1600 DPI. However, a reprogrammed button south of mouse scroll wheel that can be set to launch an app or toggle DPI out of the box is pretty common, including among Logitech mice. Logitech's rep further claimed that the two mice use different electronic components, which Logitech refers to as the mouse platform. Logitech can reuse platforms for different models, the spokesperson said. But Logitech isn't the only gadget company eager to tie one-touch AI access to a hardware button. In my opinion, can you call that an AI product? Warren Buffett is known as the Oracle from Omaha, and he's known for his financial prowess. Perhaps we should also take caution warning from him. Warren Buffett cautioned the tens of thousands of shareholders who packed an arena for his annual meeting that artificial intelligence scams could become the growth industry of all time. Doubling down on his cautionary words from last year, Buffett told the throngs he recently came face-to-face with the downside of artificial intelligence. Someone made a fake video of Buffett, apparently convincing enough that Buffett himself said he could imagine it tricking him into sending money overseas. The billionaire investing guru predicted scammers will seize on the technology and may do more harm with it than good. It has enormous potential for good and equally enormous potential for harm, and I just don't know how that plays out, he said. Buffett said Munger remained curious about the world up until the end of his life at 99, hosting dinner parties, meeting with people, and holding regular Zoom calls. For decades, Munger and Buffett functioned as a classic comedy duo, with Buffett offering lengthy setups to Munger's witty one-liners. Together, the pair transformed Berkshire from a floundering textile mill into a massive conglomerate made up of a variety of interests, from insurance companies such as Geico to BNSF Railroad to several major utilities and assortment for other companies. Nevertheless, the best applause of the day was Buffett's closing remark. I not only hope that you come next year, but I hope that I come next year. Artificial intelligence has a measurement problem. Which AI system writes the best computer code or generates the most realistic image? Right now, there's no easy way to answer those questions. There's a problem with leading artificial intelligence tools like ChatGPT, Gemini, and Claude. We don't really know how smart, or for that matter, how dumb they are. That's because unlike companies that make cars or drugs or baby formula, artificial intelligence companies aren't required to submit their products for testing before releasing them to the public. There's no good housekeeping seal for artificial intelligent chatbots, and few independent groups are putting these tools through their paces in a rigorous way. Instead, we are left to rely on the claims of artificial intelligence companies, which often use vague, fuzzy phrases like improved capabilities to describe how their models differ from one version to the next. And while there are some standard tests given to AI models to assess how good they are at, say, math or logical reasoning, many experts have doubts about how reliable those tests really are. AI editing tools are coming to all Google Photo users. Magic Editor, Photo Unblur, Magic Eraser, and more enhanced editing features are coming to all Google Photo users. No subscription required. With the right editing tools, your photos can enhance your pictures without pro-level editing skills, from removing a distraction in the background to unblurring a fuzzy shot. Many of the Google's AI-powered editing tools, like Magic Eraser, Photo Unblur, and Portrait Light, will be available to anyone using Google Photos. No subscription required. You will also be able to access these features on more devices, including Pixel tablets. Last year, Google launched Magic Editor on Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro using generative AI. This editor makes it easy to do complex photo edits with simple and intuitive actions, like repositioning your subject or turning the sky from gray to blue. Now they're expanding access to Magic Editor to all Pixel devices. Additionally, all Google Photo users on Android and iOS will get 10 Magic Editor saves per month. To go beyond this limit, you'll need a Pixel device or a premium Google One plan, which is 2 terabytes and above. These tools are rolling out and over the following weeks to all devices that meet minimum requirements. Look out for them in Google Photos to help make your pictures picture perfect. Microsoft plans to lock down Windows DNS. DNS is the phone book of the Internet that translates domain names to IP addresses. Translating human-readable domain names into numerical IP addresses has long been fraught with gaping security risk. After all, lookups are really end-to-end encrypted. The servers providing domain name lookups provide translation for virtually any IP address, even when they're known to be malicious. And many end-user devices can easily be configured to stop using authorized lookup servers and instead use malicious ones. Microsoft provided a peek at a comprehensive framework that aims to sort out the domain name system, that's DNS, mess so that it's better locked down inside Windows networks. It's called ZTDNS, Zero Trust DNS. Its two main features are 1, encrypted and cryptographically authenticated connections between end-user clients and DNS servers, and 2, the ability for administrators to tightly restrict the domains these servers will resolve. One of the reasons DNS has such a security minefield is that these two features can be mutually exclusive. Adding cryptographic authentication and encryption to DNS often obscures the visibility admins need to prevent user devices from connecting to malicious domains or detect anomalous behavior inside a network. As a result, DNS traffic is either sent in clear text or encrypted in a way that allows admins to decrypt it in a transit through what is essentially an adversary-in-the-middle attack. Admins are left to choose between equally unappealing options. 1, route DNS traffic in clear text with no means for the server and client device to authenticate each other so malicious domains can be blocked and network monitoring is possible, or 2, encrypt and authenticate DNS traffic and do away with the domain control and network visibility. ZTDNS aims to solve this decades-old problem by integrating the Windows DNS engine with the Windows filtering platform, the core component of the Windows firewall, directly into client devices. Jake Williams, the VP of Research and Development at consultancy Hunter Strategy, said the union of these previously disparate engines would allow updates to be made to Windows Firewall on a per-domain name basis. The result, he said, is a mechanism that allows organizations to, in essence, tell clients, only use our DNS server, that these TLS will only resolve certain domains. Microsoft calls this DNS server or servers the protective DNS server. By default, the firewall will deny resolutions to all domains except those enumerated in allow list. A separate allow list will contain IP address subnets that clients need to run authorized software. Key to making this work at scale inside an organization with rapidly changing needs. Networking security expert Royce Williams, no relation to Jake Williams, called this a sort of a bidirectional API for the firewall layer, so you can both trigger firewall actions by input to the firewall and trigger external actions based on firewall state output from the firewall. So instead of having to reinvent the firewall wheel, if you are an AV vendor, or whenever you just hook into WFP. New RISC-V microprocessor can run CPU, GPU, and NPU workloads simultaneously. Xsilicon Inc., that's XSI, has created a new RISC-V microprocessing chip architecture that combines a RISC-V CPU core with vector capabilities and GPU acceleration into a single chip. The CPU-GPU hybrid chip is open standard and will reportedly be open source as well. John Petty Research reports, and it's designed to handle a variety of different functions, including AI, which dedicated CPUs and GPUs would normally handle. It does all of this in a far more efficient manner. As a new design is based on RISC-V, anyone can utilize the architecture without having to pay instruction set royalty fees, unlike x86 and ARM. And if it works as intended, the chips could shake up the microprocessor industry. The standard designs currently used are, in theory, not as flexible or capable as what Xsilicon claims to have created. The new CPU-GPU hybrid is designed as a jack-of-all-trades processor. The industry has been seeking an open-standard GPU that's flexible and scalable, enough to support a variety of markets, including virtual reality, automobiles, and Internet of Things devices. This new RISC-V CPU-GPU aims to solve this issue by providing manufacturers with a single open chip design that can handle any desired workload. Xsilicon's chip is unlike other architectures, as its design combines the capabilities of a CPU and GPU into a single core architecture. This isn't like the typical designs from Intel and AMD, where there are separate CPU cores and GPU cores. Instead, the core itself is designed to handle both CPU and GPU tasks. In theory, the ability of Xsilicon's hybrid chip to handle CPU and GPU code in a same manner affords it many advantages. The chip uses the open standard RISC-V ISA, or the Integrated System Architecture for CPU and GPU, running a single instruction stream. This provides a low memory footprint execution and better efficiency, as there's no copying of data between the CPU memory space and GPU memory space. The CPU-GPU cores can be meshed together into a multi-core design, enabling manufacturers to scale up processing power as needed. In a multi-core format, multiple cores are tiled across a chip and connected using a speedy fabric. With this design, Xsilicon's CGPU architecture can potentially run any type of CPU or GPU workload. Xsilicon claims to have already have the Vulkan graphics API working with Fuse GPU acceleration. This should greatly help with its development and adoption on Android devices. Whether it works as well in practice as it does on paper remains to be seen, though we might not have to wait long to find out. Software development kits will reportedly be released to early partners sometime this year. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and a lot of how this all fits in together. I've been doing IT for ages, and I will tell you that I've also been doing work from home, at least a hybrid model, for actually quite a while. When Christopher reached out to me, he said, what are ways to maintain a work-life balance when you're working from home? And I'll tell you that this is a challenge for a number of people. And it is not always ideal. A lot of people have this idea, I'm going to work via remote, and then they find out, okay, I'm working via remote, and I'm putting in all kinds of different hours, and it's kind of messing with the whole idea of what I thought it would be. And that occurs in a variety of different ways. So first off, I'm going to say set clear work hours. Define the hours, define them, and stick to the specific start and end times for your work day. Of course, you're going to coordinate this with your management. You're going to dialogue what's going to happen if you actually need to spend some more time, if you accidentally spend more time in a particular day. You know, how does it balance out? And you probably want to find some way to have that give and play there as needed. The next thing I'm going to suggest is create physical boundaries. So my goal here is to put you into a specific area that is separate from your personal spaces, even if it is a matter of an office area or just a particular desk where you're sitting at that desk and you don't have a lot of distractions anywhere nearby that will bring you into personal instead of that work environment. So you've got to balance that work being the work area and the private being the personal being a different area. In my case, I have an office already and I turn my chair in one direction to do work. And then I turn it in a different direction to do any kind of personal items, any personal work. The next item is a matter of unplugging after hours. And this is something that, you know, it's going to vary depending on what job you do. It's going to be incumbent upon you to decide how much you are going to unplug. Maybe it's going to be up to your boss to decide. It doesn't matter. The whole idea here is powering down the system, turning off notifications. You're going to avoid checking any kind of work emails outside of work hours. You're going to try to disconnect there and stay disconnected as much as you can. Now, the next thing is plugging in during hours. So we unplug outside of hours, but during hours, I want you to reach out to the people who are your coworkers, who are in the office, your manager. You want to make sure that you are being seen as an effective part of a team, is an effective worker, as a valuable member of the company or employee of the company. So there's a balance there, and you want to make sure that you are staying connected as best you can. Sometimes that can be difficult for some people, and, you know, just try to get inside of your boss's head and say, okay, how am I going to make sure you understand? I am working when I'm via remote. Now let's flip that again back in the other direction. You need to take breaks. You need to rest, you need to recharge, you need to step away from your work area. We're talking about scheduling a lunch, scheduling a break. If you were in the office, you would go on over to the coffee room and you would spend 5-10 minutes in there. You would make sure that you're getting hydrated. You're going to make sure that you are getting away from breaking that chain that ties you to your desk. You're going to get out and about. And it only takes a few minutes. Even if you're going to just dash downstairs, upstairs, outside, whatever it is, you're going to go outside. You're going to do just a lap around your home. And that is a perfectly viable thing. You just want to free yourself for a couple of minutes at a minimum. And that's key. Make sure you do that a few times a day. Next up, or last up, I want you to make sure that you are prioritizing you. You need to prioritize self-care. You need to prioritize family. You need to prioritize play as well. You need to make time for activities that you enjoy, and those activities should help you relax and de-stress. There's nothing worse than being all tied up in knots and being tense and just focused on work all day. This is coming from me. A number of years ago, I burned out. I worked for a company that I was going in and I was arriving at 7 o'clock in the morning after a 1 hour commute, and I was going home at 8, 9, 10 o'clock, another hour in the other direction. Yeah, that was not good. And that was Monday through Friday doing the same kind of thing. Not so much on Saturdays and Sundays. You just can't do that kind of thing. And you can't do that at home. You can't be constantly attached to all of this. So be focusing on whatever it's going to take to make sure you are having a work and a life balance. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. What is the Windows Reliability Monitor? The Windows Reliability Monitor is a valuable tool for identifying software issues and monitoring system stability in the Windows operating system. It provides a system stability overview and details about events that impact reliability. And here are some of the key points about the Windows Reliability Monitor. Its purpose and functionality. The Reliability Monitor assists in the identification of software issues that may affect system performance and reliability. It constantly monitors the system state of the operating system between initial logon and system shutdown. Similar to a car's onboard computer, monitoring critical performance values. It records failures, key events regarding system configuration, and changes in both the system and reliability, allowing users to see a timeline of changes. How does it work? Like your car's onboard computer constantly monitors critical performance values such as fuel consumption, tire pressure, engine RPM, and valve load, Windows constantly monitors the system state of the operating system between initial logon and the system shutdown. Critical system components such as memory, data drives, fans, and CPU are constantly probed, and the results are collected in performance counters. System and application events, for example, Outlook send and receive activity, Word opening a document, and so forth, are individually tracked and the information is saved as event trace data. Performance Monitor uses both data collections, counters, and events to create a visual summary of performance-relevant events that occur on the system in a format that can be easily understood. Accessing the Reliability Monitor. Users can access Reliability Monitor through the Windows search box from the Start menu by typing RELIB and clicking on View Reliability History. It can also be started by running perfmon.msc from the run line. In Windows 10, it can be accessed by typing RELI in the search box or by clicking the Start button and then the settings icon and searching for RELI. With the Reliability Monitor is troubleshooting and management. The Reliability Monitor is a useful troubleshooting utility for finding out what changed during a specific time frame and can be used to manage servers and client devices. It categorizes events into critical events, warnings, and informational events, aiding in swiftly identifying and addressing issues to maintain a reliable and efficient computer system. Then there are system stability charts. The Reliability Monitor calculates the stability index shown in the system stability chart over the lifetime of the system, providing an overview of the system's stability. Compatibility and underutilization, originally intended for use by systems administrators running Windows Server 2008. The tool is relatively unknown and underutilized on Windows user-based systems. It is a native tool on supported Windows Server and desktop systems, requiring no additional installation of features or services. The Windows Reliability Monitor is an underutilized but very valuable tool for monitoring system stability, identifying software issues, and troubleshooting events that impact reliability in the Windows operating system. Tougher rules for sellers of Internet-enabled devices. Manufacturers need to follow stricter rules if they want to sell smart devices. Smart devices range from mobile phones and watches to baby monitors and game consoles. These devices can pose a risk because cyber criminals can use them to hack into home networks and steal private data. The risks have increased in recent years as homes have filled with more and more web-linked devices, from game consoles to fitness trackers, doorbells, and even refrigerators, also sometimes referred to as the Internet of Things. Manufacturers of smart devices should be expected to follow basic security guidelines, that password procedures are more secure, including ensuring any set by the manufacturer are not left blank or easy to guess choices, that there is clarity around how to report bugs or security problems that arise, that manufacturers and retailers inform customers how long they will receive support, including software updates for the devices they are buying. Failure to meet these minimum requirements should trigger big-time fines. In the United States, households now have a smart TV and more than half have a voice assistant. It's said homes contain an average of 9 connected devices, as well as basic broadband routers that can include games and toys that are linked to the web or home appliances such as radiators, ovens, and refrigerators that can be controlled remotely. There has been a proliferation of reports of hackers taking over such devices to misuse them, sometimes filming or recording covertly, spying on people, or stealing personal data. Firms making the products need to take responsibility. Businesses have a major role to play in protecting the public by ensuring the smart products they manufacture, import, or distribute provide ongoing protection against cyber attacks. It's been too easy for manufacturers to end support for older products as they roll out new models. It would be useful for consumers to be able to compare how many years of support were promised for the product they are purchasing. A longer support period suggested a manufacturer that was generally taking cybersecurity seriously. Some device manufacturers might pay lip service and do the bare minimum to make their product secure. In the UK, such a law went into effect, and in my opinion, it is a law that we should adopt in the United States where they are taking responsibility for Internet-enabled devices. ATSC 3.0 is the latest version of the Advanced Television Systems Committee standards, defining how television signals are broadcast and interpreted. It supports higher resolution like 4K and possibly 8K, along with much better sound. It has the potential to replace some of the uses of mobile data, especially within the automotive world. ATSC 3.0 can push huge volumes of data over its broadcast signals, allowing for picture and audio quality up to 4K HDR and Dolby Atmos. It also allows the same aerial to receive more channels with better quality, and portable devices such as mobile phones, tablets, and car infotainment systems can receive TV signals. The new over-the-air technology standard, ATSC 3.0, is still coming, and it is a digital signal. The most important thing with digital signals is that the signal itself be stronger than the noise around it. A stronger signal will go further most of the time, but frequency also plays a part. Digital signals tend to fall off sharply instead of getting snowier and unlike the old analog signals. The most important way to determine whether or not you'll get a channel is the signal strength when it gets to you. With ATSC 3.0, broadcasters are switching back to UHF and moving to orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, OFDM, which is the same technology behind the latest Wi-Fi and mobile wireless technologies. This change is expected to provide a better signal with less interference compared to ATSC 1.0, which was prone to interference from buildings, trees, weather, passing cars, and other sources, leading to a fragile digital signal. ATSC 3.0, the next generation of broadcast television, differs from ATSC 1.0 in several key ways. ATSC 3.0 introduces interactive features that allow viewers to interact with their TVs in a way not possible with ATSC 1.0. This includes the ability to interact with commercials, similar to interactions on phones and tablets. ATSC 3.0 is built on IP standards that mirror the 7-layer OSI data distribution model and includes HTML5 protocols. This allows it to behave much like a web page, with the television running an embedded browser to display content, providing a more tailored user experience. ATSC 3.0 provides even more services to the viewer and increased bandwidth efficiency and compression performance, which requires breaking backwards compatibility with the current version, which is ATSC 1.0. There's improved video and audio quality. ATSC 3.0 supports 4K resolution at up to 120 frames per second, high dynamic range, which is HDR, wide color gamut, Dolby AC4, MPEG-H3D audio, offering an enhanced viewing and listening experience. Data casting and personalized information, such as over ATSC 3.0, could massively expand scenarios such as news headlines, sports scores, weather, and personalized information without the corresponding LTE 5G data fees. This feature has the potential to provide a more personalized and data-rich viewing experience. Forward compatibility of ATSC 3.0 is fundamentally different from predecessor ATSC systems and largely incompatible with them. This divergence from early design is intended to allow substantial improvements in performance, functionality, and efficiency. ATSC 3.0 represents a significant upgrade over ATSC 1.0, offering interactive capabilities, improved user experience, enhanced video and audio quality, and forward compatibility with modern standards. ATSC 3.0 signals are not strictly line of sight, but the strength and quality of the signal can be affected by various factors, including interference and frequency. The switch to UHF and the use of orthogonal frequency division multiplexing technology in ATSC 3.0 are expected to provide a better signal with less interference compared to the previous ATSC 1.0 standard. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
It's Marty Winston is joining me now, and this is I know that a lot of different things that we do in life involve higher grade technology than what we had 20 years ago, 30 years ago, or like in this case. I'm going to you with you. You've got a lot of knowledge in the do-it-yourself world. My grandfather, he almost took off some of his fingers. I mean, it was a crazy accident with, he was using a table saw and he wasn't really thinking about it at the moment, got casual. And I feel like I want to get into some of this woodworking because I got a lot of things to do. And I really want to know, are saws, are they intrinsically unsafe? Is there anything that's come along that's changed the world?
Saws are a lot safer than they had been.
Okay.
User is the intrinsically unsafe part of most of it, but okay, there are exceptions. All right. Now, skill. We know the skill tool brand. It's
SKIL.
Like
word, yeah.
Yeah, like the word silk spelled inside out, right? Anyway, skill.
Yes.
A major, long-time leading brand in power saws.
Okay.
So I went to them and asked what measures are in their table saw products to prevent fingers from encountering saw blades in the first place.
Okay.
Now, they call it the Smart Guard system. There's a blade guard assembly that covers most of the exposed saw teeth on the blade without getting in the way of where the stock, the wood you're cutting, goes through the cutting line.
Mm-hmm.
One major factor that impacts hand exposure is a thing called kickback. And kickback happens on the far side of the saw.
Mm-hmm.
The saw is going down on the front edge, going up on the other edge, and that can drive it up at the split where the two pieces come apart, right? Well, most saws incorporate safety measures to reduce kickback. It can happen when the far end of the blade comes up through its slot and engages what you're cutting. Anti-kickback pawls, P-A-W-L-S, pawls, significantly reduce that. They're over that exit point and above the cut stock, limiting how high the exiting stock can jump, how far up can rise.
Okay.
Little tiny space. Now,
and you're talking, when you say stock, you're talking the wood.
Yeah, the wood.
Okay, okay.
A riving knife, or in some saws, a splitter or spreader, is just behind the saw blade and helps the pieces from each side of the cut separate. So it's a little force divider. We've been seeing them on the highway. Why not on a saw, right?
Okay, so it's kind of preventing the wood from collapsing in and then getting stuck in a blade and
snagging
kicking up.
On the blade,
Or kicking... Kick back, you said.
Kick back,
go on.
Well, there are also some inexpensive saw accessories called push sticks. A lot of guys who do carpentry make their own.
Yeah.
It's just a way to push the board through.
Mm-hmm.
It goes between your hand and the stock you're cutting. It separates your finger from the blade spin line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, looking through skills manuals, I see instructions for making your own push sticks and push blocks and feather boards, which are one way to hold small pieces in place as you cut. And you may have heard this before. Read the factory manual,
right? Yes.
The safety guidelines are excellent. Think of every way you can put your fingers where the saw blade can cut them, and they'll show you a way to avoid it. But there are some claims out there that buyer beware.
Okay, all right.
All right. Saw Stop, SAWSTOP.
I've heard of them, yes. They've got a commercial or something where people are putting hot dogs through?
They're a company that makes, and note the word I'm going to use because it has deeper meaning, they make incredible safety claims for their table saws. And when I say incredible, what I mean is that I don't believe them.
So you're saying incredible as in they lack credibility in your book. Okay.
Yeah. Their brand's core gimmick is a metal brake that stops the saw's rotation in roughly 5 milliseconds when onboard electronics detect skin contact with the user. And that's supposed to prevent cuts.
Okay.
I'm smart enough
How
to do
fast
them.
Is that blade going?
Yeah, 4,000 RPM. So
five
when I pressed the issue,
okay.
They admitted that they couldn't prevent what they termed minor cuts. But stopping the blade would prevent major ones. Oh, yeah. Their statement, quote, "Since 2004, SawStop has saved thousands of woodworkers' fingers. In journalism, that's called a boast without evidence." Or overstatement, exaggeration, or hyperbole.
How many did they not stop?
How many people really have it? Did they multiply their user base by 10 to get that? You know, my problem is that the math doesn't seem to fit.
Okay.
It's a 10-inch circular saw blade spinning at 4,000 RPM.
Okay, yeah.
That puts its circumference of saw teeth at 31.5 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And in 5 milliseconds... 10.5 inches of teeth pass by any one point.
Okay.
Even if the breaking...
That doesn't sound good.
No. Even if the breaking were not abrupt, that would be at least 6 inches of exposure. Then there's the electronics. Response times depend on the detection of a current, and that response time will have some dependency on elements like lower skin conductivity because of dryness or gloves. I asked the company to double-check my math, or if they didn't want to do that, to send me a unit so I could do my own bench tests of response time and exposure.
Put your own fingers on the line?
Yeah, they declined both. They sometimes present their products with a slow motion video demo or a demo of a hot dog touching the blade. Note that a hot dog tends to have more meat inside and more moistness outside than human fingers, which would cause faster detection of a wiener than a person. Maybe they should change their name from Saw Stop to Sausage Stop.
Oh. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, May the 23rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is bcug.com. Tech Ed Connect has a presentation, AI Tools for Seniors, Thursday, June the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets on Friday, June the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Their website is acgnj.org. The King's Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, June the 11th, 2024. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number to call is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, June the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, June the 14th, 2024. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.